once more unto the breach, dear friends, once more, or close the wall up with our English dead. In peace there's nothing so becomes a man as modest stillness and humility. But when the blast of war blows in our ears, then imitate the action of the tiger. Stiffen the sinews, summon up the blood, disguise fair nature with hard-favored rage, then lend the eye a terrible aspect. Let pry through the portage of the head like the brass cannon. Let the brow whelm it as fearfully as doth a galled rock, o'erhang and jutty his confounded base, swilled with the wild and wasteful ocean. Now set the teeth and stretch the nostril wide. Hold hard the breath and bend up every spirit to his full height. On, on, you noblest English, whose blood is fed from fathers of war proof. Fathers, like so many Alexanders, have in these parts from morn till even fought, and sheathed their swords for lack of argument. Dishonor not your mothers. Now attest that those whom you call fathers did beget you. Be copy now to men of grosser blood, and teach them how to war. And you, good yeomen, whose limbs were made in England, show us here the mettle of your pasture. Let us swear that you are worth your breeding, which I doubt not, for there is none of you so mean and base that hath not noble lustre in your eyes. I see you stand like greyhounds in the slips, straining upon the start. The game's afoot. Follow your spirit, and upon this charge, cry God for Harry, England, and St. George! Hello, 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 and welcome to this edition of The Jolly Heretic. And today I would like to talk about intergroup conflict, or what is otherwise known as war. And specifically, the issue of war, what is it good for? Which is the title of a very interesting book, which was recommended to me by one of my most wonderful followers on here, Jonathan Oliver Allen Rayner Hills Esquire, and he suggested that I might want to look into it, and it turned out to be a jolly good idea. So war, what is it good for? Or in scientific terms, intergroup conflict, what is it good for? Is intergroup conflict a good thing? Does it benefit humanity? But most importantly, is Mr. Morris right? Is Dr. Morris right in his book, War, What Is It Good For? His argument is this. Basically, under Stone Age pre-modern conditions, humans were extremely violent, quite extraordinarily violent. There is evidence, for example, that 44% of men among the Yanomamo tribe of Venezuela have killed somebody, and that the rate at which people were killed by the rate at which people were killed by murder, basically, by, you know, by violence, was 20 times higher among Stone Age societies than is the case today. So why would this be the case, he argued? Well, what he argues is this. When a group battles with another group, then it wins, because it's perhaps better organised or something like that, and consequently it creates a larger state. In order to hold this larger state together, it has to institute laws which suppress violence. In creating a larger state, it also manages to, and holding people together and making them behave less violently, it also manages to create wealth, because there's more order, there's less fighting, and so there's a greater capacity to create wealth. Consequently, the society gets rich. If people get rich, they are less likely to be violent, and if they're less likely to be violent, then violence is reduced. And so there's this movement in the history of humanity which has nothing to do with genetics or even clear environmental factors that could be articulated in scientific terms. It's simply a matter of social structures that we have got less and less violent since the Stone Age as a consequence of state building precipitated by war.
Now, it strikes me that the fundamental problem with this is the problem that you get with any theory, which is a theory of history, which is presented without a scientific dimension. Indeed, James Flynn wrote a very interesting study in 2014 called The Folly of Writing History Without a Cognitive Dimension. Cognitive, perhaps, in the broadest sense of the word. But this illustrates this. If he is correct, why is it that we know that the history of civilization goes in cycles, where you get the rise of a civilization and the growing of the state and the growing of the size of the state, and yes, things are getting bigger and bigger and bigger and bigger, and perhaps things are getting less violent, but then it collapses down again, and there's a long period of time when things are much more violent? It doesn't answer that question. Why is it that you get some states that are of similar size and power and lawful, but are, some are just more violent than others? Why is it you get some states which are simply more lawless than others, even though they are of an equivalent size? Why is it that you get some states, even now, you might compare England to Italy or something like that, why is it you get some states that seem to be basically the same, but there are differences in the level of violence? It doesn't answer any of these questions. If he is correct in his theory, then you would never expect civilization to collapse. There'd be no reason for civilizations to collapse. Why would they? Unless some insane member of the elite decided to take away law and order, which they don't. Why would civilizations collapse? It doesn't answer the question. And the way to answer the question properly and to understand what's really going on is, of course, using a cognitive dimension. So, war, what is it good for? Well, Charles Darwin proposed two dimensions for this. There's the dimension in which war is a good thing, and there's the dimension in which war is a bad thing. Now, it's a good thing in terms of what we might call, in terms of what is known as group selection. Remember, you can pass on your genes individually. You can pass on your genes, kin selection, by investing in your kin, your nieces and nephews, things like that. And you can pass on your genes at the level of the ethnic group tending to be an extended kinship group. This is what we call group selection. If you act in such a way as to help ensure that your group passes on and continues, then you are acting in a group-selected way. Now, what Darwin noticed was this. What seems to predict winning in the battle of group selection is being positively and negatively ethnocentric. And indeed, there are computer models that have shown again and again and again this is the case. Controlling for other factors, what predicts winning is that you are positively ethnocentric, i.e. you cooperate with members of your group, of your in-group, and there's low levels of intra-group violence and whatever. In that way, you cooperate, you make sacrifices for the good of your group, but also that you are harsh and violent to the out-group, that you repel the out-group as severely as can possibly be the case. This is ethnocentrism. And what he argued was that it seems to be the case that groups that have the most what he called courageous, sympathetic and faithful people, i.e. ethnocentric people who will cooperate with the group and make sacrifices for the group and lay down their lives for the group, they will tend to dominate other groups. There was another study by Alexander and Tinkle. They argued a similar kind of thing. Yes, ethnocentrism is, but also intelligence. Intelligence, of course, as we've discussed in many videos before, predicts all aspects of civilization you can think of. It also predicts impulse control, it predicts planning, it predicts being strategically superior, and so on. So what we would expect is for war to select at the group level for intelligence. We would expect the more intelligent group to win in battle against the less intelligent group, because they would be more strategic and they would produce better weapons. So we have these two factors. This was brought together by a researcher called Bigelow, who argued, well, it's two factors that are going to be relevant to groups in war. War is going to promote the group that is more ethnocentric. He used the term intergroup altruism, that is more ethnocentric and that is more intelligent. So group selection is going to be highly relevant in the boosting of intelligence. And this indeed is what myself and my colleague Michael Woodley of Manee have argued in our book At Our Wits' End, Why We're Becoming Less Intelligent and What It Means for the Future. We chart the way that we were becoming more intelligent across time between about 1100 and about 1870. We charted this with various proxies. One of them is per capita innovation, which are a sign, of course, of intelligence. The more per capita major innovations people can produce, the more intelligent they probably are becoming. And we show how we were definitely becoming more intelligent because we were selecting for intelligence, because intelligence is about 0.8 heritable, 0.8 genetic, and the richer 50% of the population had about double the number of surviving children of the poorer 50% across the period between about 1100 and about 1870. So we were definitely becoming more intelligent, and we chart this across time. But one of the things that was also happening was increasing levels of intergroup conflict, of groups fighting with each other, which reached a great intensity around about around about 1700, when, by the way, it was extremely cold, so there were very, very harsh Darwinian conditions, so there were very strong levels of intergroup conflict, so lots of conflict between groups. Now, what would have been happening in that context is that the more intelligent groups would have been, and the more ethnocentric groups, would have been dominating the less intelligent and the less ethnocentric groups, which at the group level would have been promoting as people who were more intelligent and who were more ethnocentric. That's what would have been going on. Now then we have to look at the traits that are associated with being intelligent and being ethnocentric. What are they? Well, they are being rule-following. People who are intelligent tend to be rule-following. They tend to be higher in altruism. They tend to be higher in empathy. They tend to be higher in sort of civic values and acting for the good of the group. They tend to be higher in planning and so on. So that's intelligence. And then ethnocentrism is part of a broader set of personality characteristics, including agreeableness, i.e. altruism, but being kind to other people and being empathetic, and conscientiousness, i.e. rule following. So what was essentially happening was that these wars at the genetic and by the way, these personality traits are about at least 0.5 heritable. So what wars were essentially doing at the genetic level was selecting peoples who were more cooperative and who were less violent. And so due to intelligence and due to the personality itself. And so, of course, therefore, violence is going to go down. Now, what would explain violence going back up? And therefore, what would explain the kind of observations which Ian Morris makes in his book, which he puts aside as though it's just humps and bumps in part of a general trend. It's not humps and bumps in part of a general trend. Would be the weakening of Darwinian selection. The weakening of Darwinian selection, i.e. a warmer, nicer environment, would result in the weakening of group selection, which would result in there being less intergroup conflict, which would result in there being less selection for traits which would make you less violent and whatever, which would result in people becoming more violent all over again. Equally, in less selection for intelligence, people becoming more violent all over again. And this is what you see intermittently throughout history. And you look in books by Spengler, or you can look at Our Wit's End, we look at this. You see these rises and falls of civilization based on the rise and fall of intelligence and the rise and fall of intergroup conflict. So it is this that much more neatly explains his observations than his really not very good theory, where you have to sort of accept there's humps and bumps which are inexplicable. You always know it's a bad theory if somebody talks about there being humps and bumps, I find. So this is a much more parsimonious theory as to what has been going on. And another thing that he also doesn't look at is the genetic effect of the laws which are passed in these societies to suppress violence. So one of the things that you, of course, people that are in charge, they don't want violence, and they want to sort out violence, and they want to stop violence. And one of the things that you found in England between about 11, sort of the medieval period, about 1300, something like 1200, and the early modern period, was that all felonies, that is to say all crimes which used to result in the confiscation of property, carried the death penalty. There was a very interesting paper on this by Frost and Harpending, which showed that what this meant was that 2% of the male population were executed every generation. But they weren't any 2%. They were they were young males, because young males are more criminal, because they're higher in testosterone and lower in raw intelligence, and so they tend to behave in a criminal fashion, because these are the things that predict being a criminal. But they were young, which means they could have gone on to have children, but they didn't, because they were execute. And so they demonstrate that this would have had an impact on the nature of the population in terms of cognitive factors. Now, what would it have done? Well, first of all, intelligence is negatively associated with criminality, so it would have elevated intelligence by executing 2% of the male population every generation. Secondly, criminality is negatively associated with being cooperative, i.e. with being positively ethnocentric. So executing them would have elevated positive ethnocentrism every generation. I showed in a paper that it's also negatively associated with religiousness. So it would have elevated religiousness every generation. And religiousness has been shown to be associated with positive and negative ethnocentrism, which perhaps helps you to win the battle of group selection. So this factor also contributes. So this is clearly a much more parsimonious explanation. What Morris notes, in, by the way, very interesting history, with lots of very interesting anecdotes about history and so on, is, yes, there is this general fall in violence from the Stone Age period, but we never actually collapse all the way back to the Stone Age period, so we never get back to that, but we do go in cycles, and those cycles are best explained through group selection and through intelligence. Now, then we move on to the issue of modern war. So while war in general might be seen to elevate group selection and elevate intelligence and elevate these kinds of traits, there is a second issue which militates against that, and that is the kind of people like Henry V and his band of brothers, who tend to lead people into war. Darwin noticed that if you have a standing army, it tends to be what he calls the fairest young men, i.e. the young men who are the most intelligent, because intelligence, remember, is associated with being altruistic and wanting to make sacrifices for your group. And they therefore die an early death and they don't pass on their genes. And so you would expect this potentially, particularly if there's a small population, to impact the nature of the population. There was a study which found that due to the Napoleonic Wars, the average height of French men fell from 1,642 millimetres to 1,554 millimetres. A researcher called Caleb Salibi argued that it's a reversal of normal selection processes. The best are chosen to be killed in a context of war. In the American Civil War, I'm told, according to the one study, 20% of men went to fight in the American Civil War. But this was disproportionately much higher among men who were higher education, and being educated correlated to being intelligent. 50% of male students, at the University of North Carolina fought in the American Civil War, and 34% of them died. So you can see that this could potentially have a negative effect on the intelligence and indeed the personality traits of society, because the two things that predict socioeconomic status are intelligence, but also personality, being high in conscientiousness, being high in agreeableness, being high in these values that are also likely to make you high in at least positive ethnocentrism. Equally, in World War One, we know that the people who are the officers in armies have a considerably higher IQ than the people who are the normal troops. The death rate in World War One in England was 8%. 8% of the people that went out to fight were killed. But among the officers, who tended to be from upper middle class and upper class backgrounds, and thus more educated, and in general, they would select for intelligence in becoming an officer. So the death rate among the officers was 16%. Now, you would expect this to have a negative effect. Equally, we know that World War II apparently had a negative effect on the IQ of the army. The more intelligent you were in the army, the more likely you were to die. Why? Because you're more likely to lay down your life. So in terms of this group selection model, what seems to be happening is, in general, in a war between true groups, it is the group that is the more intelligent and the more positively and negatively ethnocentric that will triumph, and thus decimate the losing group, take over the losing group, kill large numbers of members of the losing group, you know, wipe out the losing group. But it will take the winning group will take a slight hit, in so much as in achieving that, its most intelligent and most ethnocentric men may have been killed. Now, this will be balanced out. This will be balanced out overall, of course, in terms of the general history of, let's say, the broader ethnic group that we're talking about, because that broader ethnic group will become more intelligent and ethnocentric due to the destruction of a less intelligent and less group-selected group within it. But at the level of the group that has won, it will in the short term take a slight hit in terms of intelligence and in terms of ethnocentrism, because it will be the most intelligent and ethnocentric people who have been killed. So it's a rather interesting paradox. Now, of course, this only works in pre-modern times. Of course, the general tendency in a war was to completely decimate and destroy your enemies. Now, if you don't do that, if you just go in and fight them and then put them under your control and leave them alone, then what's happened then is that you've killed the best of your young men in order to do that. And they've perhaps lost the best of their young men, but for no real accomplishment. And this is why it might be argued that modern war, in which we sort of hold back and don't destroy the whole massive parts of the population of the vanquished, is not a positive thing. It's not something that's good in terms of the development of humanity, but that pre-modern war, in which there was a tendency to really lay waste to the land and lay waste to all the men of the opposing group, that would have had some sort of positive effect. But so in general, in answer to the question, war, what is it good for? In modern times, I'm afraid the answer would appear to be not much. And the theory behind war, what is it good for, simply doesn't work. You have to have a cognitive, a genetic dimension to any broad brush theory of history, or it won't work. And that's one of the things that we're trying to make clear on this channel. Now, as for this channel is under attack. They are trying to silence. All we are doing is taking academic research in peer-reviewed journals and presenting it to people in a way that is easy and hopefully quite fun to digest. And this is a problem. This is a problem. The powers that be, the SJW, the social justice warriors, the woking classes, these kinds of people, they want to keep this information secret. They want to keep the scientific truth secret and only read by a certain class of people whom they can trust. It's rather like when the Bible was translated into English in the mid-15th, 16th century, and they passed a law in England in about 1539 or 1540, saying that you had to be of the rank of gentleman and above in order to own a copy of the Bible in English. They're trying to put the genie of scientific knowledge back in the bag, and we are trying to get it out of the bag, and we're just trying to convey to people the truth, and so consequently we are being suppressed. As you may wonder why I have not been here for a while and why a lot of videos have gone down, the answer is, I would have thought, obvious to you. I have been thrown off PayPal, so you can't donate there. So it is extremely important that you help support this channel and you help support the conveyance of scientific truth in controversial areas. And to do that, please support me through Subscribestar. You can be a patron on Subscribestar, or you can simply make donations through Subscribestar, whenever you feel like it. Subscribestar is the only one we can trust. Please support me on Subscribestar, and please, let's move over to BitChute. Let's move away from this place which used to be so wonderful, where there were all these old comedies you could watch. It was kind of love-bombed us with old TV and interesting, innovative content, and has now removed all this and has become an arm of the state. So if you are watching this and a suppressor of truth and an anti-scientific organization. So if you are watching this on that certain place, please move over to BitChute and encourage others to do likewise. Okay, thank you very much. I will see you soon. And, goodbye!